Our next speaker, while he gets set up here, is Dr. Robert Melamed, and he is the assistant professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. He received his PhD from City University of New York in molecular biochemistry, and he's actually the former chairman of the biology department at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. I want to actually flagrantly rip off a term that, or a saying from Naomi Long at Drug Policy Alliance. She and I did a lecture about a week ago, and she opened it by saying she wants people in this movement to have what she calls an oh shit moment, where it finally hits them and they say, you know, oh shit, the drug war really is worse than drug use. And I steal that phrase because I first heard a lecture from Bob Melamed about 2.5 years ago, and he was talking about the endocannabinoid system, which I was somewhat familiar with. But more importantly, he put forth a theory that said, you know, we have these studies. Sometimes when we look at marijuana and the endocannabinoid system, it does this. Then we get another study and it does that. Sometimes it affects people this way. Sometimes it affects people that way. Why does it do that? And Bob came up with a theory that the endocannabinoid system, which we've discovered now, endocannabinoids almost everywhere. We heard our first speaker talk about them being in the heart. I talked about them being in the brain a little bit. We've discovered them in the digestive tract. We've discovered that newborn mice that don't have an endocannabinoid receptor system have failure to thrive. They don't suckle to their mother. They die. We've discovered that this system actually seems inherent to the most basic biological functions in life. And Bob put forth a theory that said the purpose of the endocannabinoid system is actually the oil of life. It's to maintain homeostasis. It's to keep balance in our lives. And I said, oh, shit, that really makes sense. We're not talking about symptomatic relief. We are actually talking about a system that keeps our body in balance, that keeps our body in check, that helps us healthily live and maintain the most basic biological functions that we have. And at the time, 2.5 years ago, I said, man, that's a great theory. It actually makes some sense, but, you know, it seems a little far-fetched to me. Here we are a couple years later. We've discovered so much more, and we're continuing to discover so much more about the endocannabinoid system. And like I said, I had my oh shit moment 2 years ago. I hope many of you today, maybe you'll have your first oh shit moment. But when you listen to what Bob Melamed has to say, I'm telling you, it will change your thinking about this whole concept of marijuana and medical marijuana and the endocannabinoid system. So I'm very pleased to bring up here a Dr. Robert Melamed.
Thank you very much. It's certainly my pleasure to be here. It's nothing ever is quite as nice as being in the presence of a whole bunch of stoners. It's something fundamentally different. And part of that is what I'm going to talk about now. So I couldn't resist changing my presentation a little bit when I saw today's news. The FDA says no to medical marijuana. Agency says no studies support the efficacy. You know, I'm a very conservative scientist. I'm not conservative in other ways, but scientifically I'm extremely conservative. And I'm very analytical about what's going on and very cautious about what I say. And what I want to talk to you about today is my very carefully derived conclusions over actually, many, many years. I've been a cannabis consumer now for 42 years on an almost daily basis and always proud of it. You know, and early on, it always seemed to me that this was something so good. And as the science kept unfolding and I participated in it and learned about it, I was very happy to see the way it all unfolded. So I want to communicate with you today some of the ideas that I think allow us actually to not only understand how cannabis works and the various medical properties that it has and why it's so good for us, but actually to extend that. I'm going to focus more on the extensions a little here today than I did, for example, 2 weeks ago in the patients out of time, to help try and provide us with a way of looking at why this drug war exists, and in particular, why the drug war exists against marijuana, and even more particular, you know, what kind of people are going after sick people for using their medicine. So I hope that you'll come away with an understanding as to why this insanity exists, and perhaps through that understanding, we might devise better ways of trying to make change. So And of course, I forgot to turn on my own little recorder because I have no brain. This is an article that came out literally a week or so ago. And basically, they're talking about cannabis tolerance and dependence, but there were some things that were mentioned that I think it's important for us to get a perspective on, because it's the kind of stuff that we're going to have to deal with from the what I call the primitive people, the fascist-minded primitive people that are controlling so much of the insanity today. In humans, abstinence from continual marijuana use leads to delayed withdrawal symptoms manifesting as psychological symptoms of decreased appetite and weight loss, as well as emotional changes, which include irritability, anxiety, restlessness, and strange dreams. Accepting that these symptoms reflect a clinically significant withdrawal symptoms syndrome is gaining acceptance. So this clearly shows what one of the attacks, the nature of one of the attacks that's going to come and is being supported by this kind of interpretation. And what I want to do is, before I get into what I wanted to talk about, just give you a little armament for deflecting the stupidity that we're seeing here and why, in fact, this is stupid. You know, if you take a population of people, we all have these cannabinoid receptors, we make cannabinoids, we break them down, but we all do it that in a manner that's unique to us. Just like we all look differently, all of our biochemistry is different as well. We have the same genes, but we have different flavors of those genes that are all controlled in different manners. Well, look at the things that they're talking about here. Irritability. Well, we know marijuana makes you a little bit more relaxed, a little less irritable. We know that it can reduce anxiety. We know that it helps promote sleep. And I know about everybody else, but I know myself, one of the things I love best about stopping marijuana use is I really enjoy dreams. And when I consume, I almost never remember my dreams. It's not that you don't dream, you just don't remember them. So it's always such a pleasure to, you know, find this whole new world of reality, of pseudo-reality at least, when I stop. Well, what we're seeing in a population of people are people who have needs for cannabis to deal with their irritability, their anxiety, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when they stop taking it, of course those symptoms are going to come back. So I wrote back to these authors a week ago, and I said, suppose somebody was on antibiotics because they had an infection, and they took the antibiotics for 3 days instead of 10 days so that they didn't kill the bugs, and the bugs started to grow again, and the infection came back. Would you call that a withdrawal symptom? I never got an answer back from these people. But this group typically tries to paint marijuana in a negative manner, and it's just so absurd. But, of course, that's where funding comes from. So anyway, what I really want to talk to you about is evolution, marijuana, and prohibition, because I want to draw a continuity between the change that's occurred in the biosphere, really, in organisms that have cannabinoid systems and what that means, and then how that can be extended, how an understanding of that biology can be extended to an understanding of prohibition. So I'm going to rapidly go through some of the stuff. Some of you have heard it in the past, but I have to start in the beginning in order to provide the comprehensive overview, because it's the comprehensive overview that I really want to try to convey to you. So what I want to start with is the physics of life. What is the physics of life? Is there a physics out there that we can look at and describe in a relatively simple manner so that it can be shared by all and yet provide concepts that allow us to understand really what is the fundamental nature of life? And in order to do that, we're going to go just very, very simplistically and rapidly through a concept of called far from equilibrium thermodynamics. It's much easier than it sounds, at least at the way I can present it. And out of that, we're going to see the development of the concept of homeostasis and what that means. But I want to take homeostasis not only from within our body, but outside of our body into our social environment and our political environment, et cetera. So from the body perspective, what I want to do is describe health and illness and the relationship of health and illness to homeostasis and how that physics underlies it. And then extend that into what's going on with the cannabinoids, what are they doing, and how do they participate in all of those things. And from that, we'll then go into human behavior, and from human behavior into politics, and then from politics into religion. And I And that's the answer. So anyway, far from equilibrium thermodynamics, I put this slide in here on the one hand out of respect, because Ilya Prigozhin was the master behind this. He spent his life developing this theory and philosophy and science and math, and one of the most incredible humans to ever have lived. And this quote from him is very telling. The more deeply we study the nature of time, because he was into time, we don't really know, what's time, you know? How do you, we know how to measure it with a clock, but what's really going on there? And he's just come up with some incredible things there. The better we understand that duration means invention, creation of forms, continuous elaboration of the absolutely new. This is really what cannabis is about. So we'll see how that is in a moment. So what I want to do is show you how, from a physical and chemical point of view, energy flows. And when energy flows, it has the most amazing creative capacity. And it's that creative capacity that's behind life. So what I'm going to talk about is something that's a little different from something that you may be familiar with, the term entropy, that disorder must increase, and life is in contrast to that. Well, that's because the old view that would allow you to see in contrast to is really not appropriate. Equilibrium situations, when you move a little bit from equilibrium, entropy, which is disorder, will increase. However, when you are far from equilibrium and energy can flow, we'll see that molecules, innate molecules, have a creative capacity to organize themselves. And it's that organizing capacity that's responsible for life, that is a measure of health, and is manifest in terms of our social, political, economic, communities, families, everything. Everything. Because if things are happening, this is how they happen. All right. So what we're looking at here is something called the Bernard instability, and that's a Petri dish about that big. It's got about 10 mLs in it of a solution. And if you heat it from below, everything that you're taught in most of the schools in this country and around the world, but not all, is that all those molecules are going to do is move faster, spin faster, and vibrate faster. And there's nothing else you would ever expect out of them. However, what you're seeing here is that they have actually organized themselves into these hexagonal convection cells. So you see the hexagons, and what's happening, if you look from the side, that's a picture from the top. You look from the side, you see the cells are being heated from below, the hot molecules are going up the sidewalls, and then on top they're cooling above, and then you see that little center area in each hex, they're going back down. So we have like a little molecular heat brigade, kind of like a bucket brigade, where tens of trillions of molecules have organized themselves to accomplish this task of better transporting the heat from below to above. Essentially, what I'm saying, and this is a very simplistic formicles that don't want to have them, they want to give them off, other things want to take them, so you can have the flow of electricity, essentially, of chemical electricity. And there's an indicator in there, something that shows up, whether there's a lot of electrons that want to be given off or a lot of electrons where they want to be. You get a different color. And that's what you're seeing. So here in a liquid that we assume always to be just random, we see that there are actually, in this case, organized patterns. Very similar to the convection cells, but here, rather than being generated by heat flow, they're generated by electron flow. And we call that redox reactions, and that's what we are. We eat food that has reduced hydrocarbons, things that you can burn. We breathe out CO2 and water, things that are fire extinguishers. Where did the energy go? It goes into constructing us, to maintaining our organization, and we have to continuously do it because we need that continuous flow. We're not static. We are far from equilibrium. Okay, so that's a basis here. And then I just show you a quick picture here because it leads to the next one as well. This is one of those Zabotinsky reactions. I'm shaking it up very thoroughly so we all see that it's homogeneous. We expect no organization. It's mixed. You let it sit a second, and out of the chemistry that's there, out of these dumb molecules, we're going to see a blue color start on the bottom and move up the tube. That's that redox indicator telling us there's a change happening. It disappears, and it comes back again and again. As long as there are electrons where they don't want to be and they can get to where they want to be, that reaction keeps happening. Why is it important? Think about living people. We breathe with rhythmicity, our heartbeats, our brain waves, menstrual cycles, sleep cycles. We are nothing but collections of these kinds of oscillations, these periodic oscillations. That is a fundamental characteristic of all living things. And we'll see in a second here that, well, first of all, There's a term for these things. They're called dissipative structures. But the key point here is that large collections of molecules existing far from equilibrium intrinsically have this creative capacity. And this is all from the work of Prigogine. Dissipative structures is a phenomenon basically that he's discovered. And he got the Nobel Prize for this. So we're not talking about a slouch here. This is part of what I want to embrace in the idea of what happens with these kinds of phenomena. Compare that to that. You know, one means nothing and is gibberish. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts when it's given to you in the appropriate context, all right? This allowed our brains to have flow occur. We could make associations in the second-hand case and not in the first case. And they're the same parts there. The point I want to make is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And this is a very critical phenomena because that's true in terms of every aspect of our biology, and it's true about our society, our economics, our politics, etc. I mean, think about it. A dollar bill. What is a dollar? Why is it worth something? It's only worth something because it can plug into the reality around it. Otherwise, it's meaningless. Why have value to a dollar, you know? Go to some primitive tribe and say, hey, look at, you know, give me some food. Here's a dollar. It means nothing, you know? It's only in context that things mean things. And that's what I mean, again, by the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. So take-home message here is that inanimate molecules can collaborate and cooperate. It's a natural phenomena. Why haven't we learned it as a society as a whole? And aren't the cannabinoids from our own personal experiences fundamentally involved in our ability to collaborate and cooperate, to change our minds, to be open? You're in a particular situation, new information comes, you adapt, you change. That's part of what collaboration is about. So if we look at the biosphere, we see really that this kind of physics that I'm talking about is permeating all levels of our global biosphere. If you look at your weather patterns, they all are these dissipative structures, the formation of tornadoes, weather patterns, you know, everything is the same kind of a process occurring as we have here. And then you have life itself, also the same thing. So that's really basically the Gaia hypothesis, if you're familiar with that. So what we're looking at, what we've looked at, is essentially how the new physics and biology meet, and that far from equilibrium thermodynamics provides us with a framework for understanding what life is. So now let's look a second at what's the fundamental characteristics of life, how that stuff turns into living things and what it brings with it. So one of the key things here is the concept of homeostasis. In medicine and biology, this term is applied to the inherent tendency in an organism towards maintenance of physiological and psychological stability. Well, illness is when you're out of balance, you know? No matter what illness you're talking about, it's something that's out of balance. The flow is not occurring in a sufficiently nutritive manner to maintain the organism's distance from equilibrium, and it gets more disordered and approaches equilibrium. That's also, by the way, what aging is, and we'll go into that in a minute. So living systems are composed of many thousands of interacting biochemical thermostats. And what I mean here is not that they're regulating heat, but they're regulating this flow that I keep talking about. And they're everywhere and they're on all levels. They're within your cells, they're between your cells, they're in your organs, between your organs. It's how all of these layers of communication coordinate so that we can sit here and talk about this stuff. All right. This is just a chart showing you that in many cases, the way our cells work, when you look at the chemicals within our cells, we see that they have these oscillatory properties. And some of them are oscillating in phase with each other, and others are oscillating out of phase. And without going into the details, on the right, there are simply abbreviations for the names of chemicals that are showing this phenomenon. And it so happens that those are chemicals involved in the fundamental aspects of our metabolism, in other words, how we generate energy to be alive. So these oscillations are right there happening within our cells. All right. So what is life and what is aging? All living systems are, in fact, bioelectric. As I've been saying, the electricity is flowing. The electrons are going from our foods to our wastes. All right, electrons flow from where they don't want to where they want to be. The biochemical reactions that constitute life are the wires. It's how these electrons flow from where they're charged to where they're discharged. All right, those are the wires. It's our chemistry. It's our unique biochemistry. And even though we're all the same, we're all different. And when electrons flow, some of them leak out, and some of them form what we call free radicals. And many of us are free radicals, but I don't mean that kind. I mean the kind that occur within your biochemistry. And what do they do? Well, on the one hand, they perturb the chemistry. All right. What they wind up doing is interacting with your DNA, your RNA, your fats, and your proteins, and they alter their chemistry. Most obviously, when you alter the chemistry of your DNA, you're creating mutations. And since these free radicals are occurring because we are alive, the longer you're alive, the more you accumulate this damage. It's kind of like biochemical rust or biochemical friction. Okay. It's an increase in disorder. Entropy is slowly increasing with us as we try to stay away from going back to equilibrium, which is death. So on the one hand, we see free radicals as being very negative because they are, in fact, believed to be responsible for all age-related diseases and, in fact, aging. On the other hand, they are signaling molecules that tell us how efficiently we are interacting with our environment. Because remember, we got to be sucking in from our environment to maintain ourselves, all right? And as soon as there are little changes, we've got to be able to adapt so that we're in harmony again, right? And part of the ability to do that is because when we screw things up a little bit by not interacting appropriately, then we make free radicals and some of our body, some of our cellular systems are designed to detect that and to try and change us biochemically so we better interact with the environment so we can keep sucking out what we need, all right? So there's a good and bad side to them. Changes allowing for altered biochemical, they allow for changes to reestablish smooth flow of essentially those electrons and to minimize negative free radical consequences. Well, it turns out that cannabinoids have a very fundamental role in this process because they wind up regulating homeostasis, these balancing acts, these thermostats that I keep talking about. And they do it everywhere. This is so amazing. They do it everywhere. They are so integrated into man's life, and not only man's life, but really life through multiple layers of evolution. The cannabinoid system was first the origins of it can be traced back 600 million years ago. That's when cells first started to communicate and cooperate with other cells. That's prior to the development of digestive systems and nervous systems and all of that. Just simple communication and effective collaborative interaction so that they could survive better. All right? So we see now that the cannabinoids are in the cardiovascular system where they protect your heart, as was discussed. They lower your blood pressure in many circumstances. They reverse arterial sclerosis. This is the latest data coming out of mice again. But there's molecular mechanisms to all of this. I don't have time to explain it all, but there's a foundation, you know, to all of the things that I'm talking about, a coherent foundation having to do essentially with free radical production. All right? Cardiovascular disease really in many respects is an autoimmune disease because it's your immune system through inflammation that's screwing things up, and the cannabinoids have a fundamental role in modulating that and turning off that aspect. Remember the balancing act. We make inflammation, we turn it off. That's occurring throughout us, and the cannabinoids are very anti-inflammatory in that respect. So in our digestive system, we see the cannabinoids involved with things like gastrointestinal reflux disease, ulcers, nausea. You know, not simply masking symptoms. We're talking about changing the fundamental biochemistry that leads to these illnesses. In the endocrine system, the pituitary hormones are regulated, some of them, not all of them, by cannabinoids. But remember, this is the master gland. So we're talking about that which is mastering the master here, all right, are cannabinoids. Things like prolactin, which is involved not only in lactation and the production and promoting certain breast cancers from growing, but also mood activities, et cetera. Ghrelin is one of these gut hormones involved in our appetite and digestion. They regulate our excretory system, things like diarrhea. They used to be used as a treatment for cholera. You know, urinary frequency. You know, if you've watched TV, you see, as was mentioned earlier, nothing but drug advertisements. And in one case, they're talking about, you know, this pill is going to help you with your incontinence. And if you actually go and look at the data, you'll have 1/10 less of a piss a night. You know, hey, this is a big thing, but it passed clinical trials. You know, it's something we should invest our money in, 1/10 less of a piss. Cannabis has recently been shown to have, I think it's a 40% reduction in urination in multiple sclerosis patients. it really is a big relief, you know, for many other reasons with MS patients. But this is just another one because, once again, we're looking at a whole, your body and your body's activity being greater than all of those little parts. And here we're having this one collection of molecules, these cannabinoids, touching so many places to allow for higher levels of coordination. And what's the outcome? Among others, whether we're happy or not. You know, happiness, you're not going to be happy if you're falling apart, usually. You know, we deal better if we have a mindset that allows us to. And the cannabinoids are helping us with all that. So they modulate our immune system. Our immune system in general, in a very simplistic sense, is a balance of two opposing forces, pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory. And we need both arms. But we need them at different times. You know, 100 years ago, people were dying in this country. 100 years ago, people were dying at a younger age, and they were dying from infectious diseases for the most part. Well, now we're not, in general, dying from infectious diseases. We're dying from age-related diseases, arteriosclerosis, multiple sclerosis, autoimmune diseases like diabetes, etc., Alzheimer's disease. All of these diseases are believed to have as their foundation, as their etiological agent, free radicals, which we know cannabinoids help protect against. So things like arthritis, ALS, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease, these are all autoimmune diseases that are involving the pro-inflammatory imbalance. That's the imbalance that cannabinoids would be good for because of their anti-inflammatory nature. If you were imbalanced on the other side, cannabinoids would be bad for you. And there are certain circumstances where cannabinoids are very bad for you. Certain infections, things like Legionella's disease, leprosy, Leishmania, one important one, tuberculosis, thank you. So diseases that require a strong inflammatory immune response, you should stay away from cannabis. It could kill you. And there are animal studies that have shown where you, for example, give THC to mice that are infected with Leishmania, the mice that get the THC all die. Because the explosion of the inflammation of the infection. So again, we have to be intelligent. Nothing is all one-sided. But cannabis is shifted very much towards the good side. Why? Because we all share a common biochemical imbalance. We are all getting older. We are all aging. We are all accumulating damages, and the cannabinoids help protect us against that. So they are essentially anti-aging drugs. So the musculoskeletal system was already mentioned, ALS, recently shown involvement in osteoporosis. Even the production of the runner's high is now attributed to cannabinoids. So if you go out and run like I do and you like it, you know, part of the reason you like it is because you're getting off a little here on your endocannabinoids legally, and they can't do anything about it, you know? Your nervous system, we had a nice discussion on that. You know, I just want to point out, though, a lot is known about what Alzheimer's is. It's the end point, you know, these neurofibrillar tangles. What's also known is the molecular mechanism that shows why there are people who like can't believe how good they are and how they regain capacity once they go from not having been cannabis users to being cannabis users. It's like miraculous to these people. Also learning, and this is very critical here, the whole idea of learning, because what cannabinoids are very involved with are forgetting. But you know what? In order to learn something new, you often have to forget something old because you got to reprogram, you know? If you learn that marijuana is bad, it's the dangerous killer drug. Well, if all the science that I talk about is real and you read it, you've got to be able to throw away the old and learn the new, okay? And this is going to be very important to where I'm going because I'm running out here. All right, I'll be very quick then because I'm missing my key points here, and they're not there. And we'll eliminate the fact that cannabinoids kill all these different cancers, free radicals are the friction of life, cannabinoids extend life in mice, there's a mind-body connection. I'm suggesting, in fact, that the placebo effect might be due to cannabinoids. It'll be something very interesting at some point to find out the answer to. Just give me a little bit of time here. In a population of people, you're going to have people who have high levels of cannabinoids, people who have lower levels. Unavoidably true. It's like indisputable truth. You're going to have an average level. People are going to be above average. People are going to be below average. All right. Some people, therefore, are higher. Some people, therefore, are lower. All right. The average state of the high in the population. Well, here we have a couple of, I would presume, potentially low cannabinoid people. They can't relearn. okay? And then you have people, you know, who are inventive, who are peaceful, who are loving, you know. These people probably had high levels of cannabinoids. And what we are dealing with today is a genetic battle. Cannabinoids regulate learning by help us to forget, all right, so that we can learn new things.